criteria. If something is always on the media, then is it good and true, or maybe is it not? Then we should not take the news out too serious, 'cause they're teaching us. Don't you think the news are just my people who are leading us? They're showing us what they want and we consume it, but we need to stop. Independent media needs to be this, let's beat it up. We're definitely losing propaganda war if we get propaganda.
What you know about life? What you know about the news that the media hype? Say what you know about the cultures in Africa. What do you know about my people smoking sensimilla? What do you know about the war going on in us? What do you know about the system with the peace of happiness? Say what you know about the source where your message is from. Propaganda warfare is going on.
Propaganda warfare is going on.
Den Fernseher lieber aus, habe mich zurückgezogen in mein kleines sicheres Haus. Ich beobachte Tag für Tag aus einer geschützten Position. Und was ich da sehe, das mag ich nicht.
Ich glaub es nicht, oh. Du kannst mir erzählen, was du willst, solange du nur eine Seite kennst. Hast du keine Sicherheit, die andere als dein Feind zu nennen. Du musst dir schon die Mühe machen, beide Seiten zu verstehen. Dann kannst du auch ohne Zweifel ein gerechtes Urteil geben. Hast du Zweifel, dann glaub es nicht. Glaub es nur, wenn du sicher bist. Hast du Zweifel, dann glaub es nicht. Glaub es nur, wenn du sicher bist.
Propaganda, Propaganda warfare, so in Aganda. 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 Propaganda warfare, so in Aganda.
Thanks for returning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can listen to this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. If you're just joining us, we're listening to The End of American Exceptionalism with Andrew Bacevich.
But I myself am persuaded that the real reason we didn't invade Iraq because it was strong. We invaded it because it was weak. We invaded Iraq because they truly believed. I mean, it's bizarre. It didn't work, but they truly believed that we were so powerful that we could remake the region, and that by remaking the region wouldn't be a problem. And Iraq was the place to begin this. We didn't send U.S. troops to South Vietnam because we thought we were going to remake Southeast Asia. Fundamentally different purpose. Both wars deeply misguided. But I don't see much in terms of comparability, except that always domestic politics weighs in and leads politicians to be less than courageous.
Good evening. Do you foresee sometime in our lifetimes another country or a group of countries rising or forming to oppose American exceptionalism? I mean, do you foresee America sometime in our lifetimes becoming not only not a superpower, but almost irrelevant, just another country? Are we so far militarily, technologically ahead of other countries that it's not going to happen anytime soon?
Well, no, I mean, the United States will continue to be the most powerful country in the world through your lifetime, would be my, that's what my crystal ball would say. But the notion that the United States is going to be uniquely powerful, I think that that was an illusion back in the 1990s when that was all the talk, and events have certainly disproven it. My guess, I don't think you have to be too clairvoyant to say this, is that we're moving into a multipolar age in which there are going to be several very important powers whose considerations in the realm of great power politics, who are going to have a vote. We're going to have a vote, but so are the Chinese, so are the Indians, probably the Russians, you know, in their weird way, the Europeans, and maybe some others, maybe Brazil, maybe Turkey. But that there's that to the extent that your generation avoids catastrophic war on a scale of World War I or World War II, that will occur if you're able to figure out some way for these several great powers to tolerate one another. Not love one another, but to tolerate one another, and therefore to avoid great power conflict. And we will certainly have a very important role to play in that. But we can only play that role effectively if we get over the notion that we're in charge.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. American Exceptionalism with Andrew Basevich.
Yes.
All right.
You look old for a student.
Well, I thought I'd introduce the community part. I'm not a historian, but I have lived through a bit of history, and I really appreciate the clarity with which you bring light on what has brought us to this place, politically and militarily, and in terms of our goals and misguided goals. My question is a simple one. How do we get out of this mess? I'd really like to hear your reflections, not so much looking back, but looking ahead. What insights do you have to help bring us forward from this place of, you use the word insolvency, I'll say bankruptcy. Bankruptcy economically and morally. How do we get out of this?
I think that Jimmy Carter, who most people think was a decent guy, but a failure as president, gave a very important speech back in the summer of 1979, famously known as the Malaise Speech. People my age will remember it. All you young people will have no idea what I'm talking about. But here's your homework assignment. Go when you get back to your room, just Google Carter Malaise Speech. And The text will come up, and if I'm not mistaken, there's a YouTube, you can watch the whole thing on video if you want to. And what Jimmy Carter, this is a context. Summer of 79, the economy's been in the pits for years. There's so-called stagflation, high unemployment combined with high inflation, low growth, hangover from Vietnam, basically. The Shah has been overthrown. Energy prices are going through the roof. The Carter's political opponents say that he's weak on communism and he's allowing the Soviets to get ahead. It's probably not true. But he's really been battered. And there's this guy called Ronald Reagan who is waiting in the wings and really wants to be president. And so Carter is really on the ropes in the summer of 79. And he goes on TV and he gives a speech. And he says, look, I was going to come and give you a speech on the energy crisis and give you a five-point plan on how to deal with the energy crisis. But then he said, no. I thought more deeply. Matter of fact, I invited a bunch of people to come up to Camp David to tell me what a bad president I am. It's a very strange speech. And he said, based on that, I have reached an important conclusion. And I want to share it with you, my fellow Americans. And my conclusion is that in a very fundamental sense, the country, all of us, have taken the wrong road. And we've taken the wrong road because as the people who believe in freedom, we have misconstrued freedom. We have embraced a materialistic definition of what it means to be free. We have organized our society around stuff and its acquisition and consumption. And oh, by the way, our endless appetite for oil is an example of that. And what we need to do, my fellow Americans, is therefore, I'll use the Catholic sort of perspective here, engage in a collective examination of conscience. We need to come to realize that we individually and collectively have gone down the wrong path. We need to ask ourselves what it means to be free. And then we need to reorganize our society in ways that will enable us individually and collectively to live in accordance with that definition of freedom. And oh, by the way, he said, actually, energy offers the way for us to begin that reorientation of American society. Instead of assuming that we have to have more and more and more and more oil and gas, what if we learn to do with less? And drive 55 miles an hour and park your car once a week and tighten your belts. In a sense, to bring about a moral reorientation of the country. Thank you and good night. And the American people said, what? What are you asking me to do? Tighten my belts? Get by with less? Park my car once a week? And they absolutely, totally, and completely rejected that. 6 months later, January 1980, Carter speaks before a joint session of Congress, State of the Union address, and promulgates the Carter Doctrine, which says the Persian Gulf is a vital national security interest of the United States of America, and we will fight for it to make sure nobody owns it except us. In other words, reverse course, abandon his position. So Carter was right, in my judgment. The way to save the country is for us to ask ourselves what we mean by that which we profess to value most. What does it mean to be free? What are the requirements of living? What is the definition? What are the requirements of living in accordance with a true definition of freedom? And then organize our society accordingly. And that ain't never going to happen, I'm sorry to say.
Not done yet. We're getting close to being done. Okay? two more questions, two and a half, and then we'll go into the foyer and sign books and eat cookies and talk more about politics, okay? Two and a half questions. Okay.
Now, there are three gentlemen standing here. Which of them gets the half question?
Well, my question is a follow-up to what you just communicated about President Carter. When we look at classical thinkers like Aristotle...
Like who?
Aristotle. In his Politics, he said that really political institutions are a reflection of a man's inner heart, of his inner soul. And when you look at Machiavelli, who said, you know, to the victor goes the spoils, can we in the United States rediscover a sense of what victory is in the light of the ruling by the Supreme Court about Citizens United, that corporations are people too? And if you were to decide a foreign policy, if you were on the Joint Chiefs of Staff for the United States, how would you define victory as we look forward in the 21st century? And how do you explain why when we win a war, we don't take what we're fighting for?
Well, I think there's only 2.5 questions, and he just asked 8. I'm not sure I understood all your questions. Seriously. Let me go to the pretend you're the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff part. And this is really the subject of the book that I published a month or so ago, and I alluded to it a little bit in the talk. I think that the gap between the military and society is a fundamental problem. And it's a fundamental problem in that it underwrites irresponsibility with regard to our military policies, because we don't have a stake in the game. And that there is an urgent need to reconstitute the tradition of the citizen soldier, to recognize that although the so-called all-volunteer force has many positive aspects, it's not the right military system for this country. And that needs to be rethought. And doing that would implies a fundamental redefinition of what it means to be a citizen in this country in ways that would be probably difficult for a lot of people to accept, but I think on balance would be very useful.
My son is a 19th century diplomatic historian, and he jokes that Turkey lost its chance to be a member of the European Union in 1879 during the Balkan crisis, where it was at war with Russia. Now, my family comes from the borderland between Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire, and it's been my contention that those are the only two empires that really figured out how to manage multi-ethnic, multilingual, multi-confessional state.
Who, the Russians and the Turks?
No. The Ottomans and the Austro-Hungarians.
Oh, okay.
Without resorting to massive violence. And I wonder what we can learn from the Ottomans, because they actually had a quite weak central government. What can we learn from weakness rather than strength?
You probably have to ask your son. I mean, my understanding of the Ottoman Empire sort of begins in 1914 when the Brits and the French decide to dismantle it. And
yeah, we're still suffering from the mistakes they made.
That's correct. I agree with that 100%. But it's difficult for me to praise their weakness, because it was the weakness of the Ottomans that, in a sense, made them vulnerable to these two European imperial powers that, when it suited them to dismantle the Ottoman Empire, they just went and did it. So to some degree, it seems to me a cohesion and internal strength are not to be sniffed at. So I don't know that I can answer the question about what can we learn from their weakness. So you have a half question.
I have a half question. I thank you for your very provocative speech. It seems to me the United States has assumed for itself the right to operate its drone warfare machinery and the NSA anywhere in the world at its whim, absent diplomatic permissions or honoring international borders or treaties. I guess one half the question is, do you see that as sustainable practice? And B, if the president of Pakistan hypothetically decided that the president of the United States was a terrorist, wouldn't he have the exact same legal right to assassinate our leaders?
Well, I mean, we're not trying to assassinate the president of Pakistan, but the basic point, I think, has merit. What we have done since 9/11 has been to assert prerogatives, claiming that the things that we're doing are necessary in order to prevent another 9/11. The Bush doctrine of preventive war, the Obama practice of targeted assassination, the vast expansion of intelligence collection, that's been in the press lately. And the argument has been that, I'm sorry, we have to do these things or another 9/11 is inevitable. And the problem with the argument is that any expectation that we will therefore control or be the only ones to exercise these prerogatives is ridiculous. We are establishing precedents, and other nations will employ those precedents, and they will justify their actions by citing things that we have done. And, you know, I mean, the chickens are going to come home to roost, and it ain't going to be pretty.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime. And bad mistakes I've made a few. I've had my shouts and kicks in my face, but I've come through.
I need to go on.
And everything that goes with it, I thank you all. But it's been no bed of roses, no pleasure cruise. I consider it a challenge before the whole human race, and I ain't gonna lose.
Thank you.
That's all, folks.